Welcome to Macro Musings, where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the most important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I am your host, David Beckworth, a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and I'm glad you decided to join us. Our guest today is Josh Lipsky. Josh is the Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomic Center, and he joins us today to discuss the tools of financial statecraft and how they have evolved over the years and their implications going forward for digital currencies. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, David. Really pleased to be here.
Great to have you on. I've been following the work that you're doing there on payments, cross-border payments, digital currencies, and of course, financial statecraft. We're going to talk about all of that today, but maybe start us off by talking about your work there, what the Atlantic Council is and what it's doing and how you got there.
Yeah, happy to do that. So I've been at the Atlantic Council 4 years. I was at the IMF before that as an advisor and speechwriter to Christine Lagarde. And prior to the IMF, I was at the State Department for about 3 years. And having been at State and then been at the IMF, I had this realization that oftentimes those two institutions are working on similar issues, but they don't speak the same language. So at State Department, for example, you might be dealing with the rise of terrorism in a certain region. At the IMF, you might be dealing with hyperinflation in that same country. But we don't talk a lot about counterterrorism at the IMF, and we don't talk a lot about hyperinflation at the State Department. And so when I left the IMF, I had this idea that it would be useful in Washington to have a center that was at the intersection of national security, finance, and foreign policy. You know, in Washington, we have the Peterson Institute, the sort of macroeconomic gold standard work going on. We have the traditional foreign policy think tanks. Atlantic Council is one of them, Council on Foreign Relations. And I wanted to build something that was the intersection of the two. And that's where the idea of geoeconomics came from and the center came from. And we've built it out over the last 4 years. We do a range of work, as you said, on digital currencies, China's economy, economic statecraft. And in the first 2 years, I always had to explain to everyone what geoeconomics meant. But since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and especially the G7 sanctions response, I always say I don't have to explain it anymore. Everyone just intuitively understands what geoeconomics is. We live it. The only other thing I'd say is that geoeconomics is not a new idea. It's an old idea. We're marking the 80th anniversary of the Bretton Woods institutions this summer. Those are geoeconomic institutions founded during a war, not after a war. And so what I think is in the West, we have to rediscover geoeconomics. It's actually how a lot of countries operate every day. It's how India operates. It's how China operates. A lot of emerging markets operate from a geoeconomic posture. We are rediscovering what geoeconomics means here in the United States.
Maybe the economists are rediscovering geoeconomics. I think political scientists like yourself and lawyers have been on top of it for some time. But I know in our field, at least, it's something that we are addressing again. We've had some previous guests on the show who've been exploring this topic. We've had some political scientists as well. We've had Dan McDowell, for example, on the dollar dominance, number of guests. So very topical, very fascinating, and very important, I think, is the point you're trying to make here. It's national security, it's financial statecraft, all those wonderful things. Well, let's look at some financial statecraft issues, and let's start with a case study, a very prominent one right in front of us today, and that's the Ukraine war. And two parts of that, both the financing of it, but also the sanctions that were applied in 2022 to Russia and how we have supported Ukraine through these various mechanisms of financial statecraft. And let me begin first with the financial sanctions. So if my understanding is correct, Russia had around $600 billion in foreign assets, and we were able to freeze around $300 billion of that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's $600 billion in total reserve assets, but about $300 that were held outside of Russia. And that's the amount. It's probably closer, we think, now to $280 billion that was actually blocked. We say blocked instead of frozen. This is a semantic debate inside the Atlantic Council. But about $280 blocked, frozen, and the vast majority of that, about 220 in Europe, in euros predominantly. And that's an important distinction when we talk about how those assets are used. And that is what has put so many constraints and so much G7 negotiation about what to do with those assets. They're held in Euroclear, European Clearinghouse in Belgium. So we always think it's important when we talk about the assets to get nuanced, to get detailed. What do we mean? How much is it? Who's holding it? In what kind of currency?
Okay, so most of it that is held outside of Russia, these reserves, are held in Europe, which I guess means that U.S. has less ability to use financial statecraft directly. It's going to have to go with partners, have a coalition. And, you know, something that's interesting to me, Josh, kind of sitting back and looking at this development is coming out of Iran when we dropped the deal with the Europeans, they were livid at us, right? They were mad. In fact, we imposed, I believe, both primary and secondary sanctions. So, you know, European businesses who kind of invested into Iran again, suddenly they found out they were on the wrong end of the financial sanctions deals. So they were ticked off and they just tried to develop their own payment system. But then come forward to 2022 and all of a sudden we're all on the same page again. Everyone's happy. Everyone's singing from the same page of the choir book. So we've kind of maybe mended some of those hurt feelings from earlier, but still we depend upon Europe playing its role as well. So we have the financial sanctions. I'll come back to them in a minute. And I want to talk about how effective they've been. Also, sanctions on banking in Russia. Is that right? And sanctions on oil and import exports. Is that fair?
Yeah, these are some of the most sweeping sanctions ever put on a G20 economy. Wide ranging. Many banks de-swifted, though not every bank, as we've shown through our work at the Council and the Global Sanctions Dashboard that my colleague Kim Donovan runs, but many banks outside the SWIFT system now. But it is important to say, especially at the beginning, wide exceptions for energy. And so it's very hard to sanction a current account surplus country that is an energy exporter and leave out the energy exports loophole in the sanctions. So we'll talk about the effectiveness of the sanctions, David, but I don't think an economist would have any trouble understanding why they may not have been effective as many assumed at the beginning when you have that kind of hole in the sanctions regime.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. How effective have the sanctions been that were introduced in 2022 relative to expectations?
Yeah, well, the key statement there, David, is relative to expectations, right? And this is so important because in the beginning, expectations were set that this was going to cripple the Russian economy. And that was never realistic. You know, sanctions have to work in complement with a range of other tools. Many of them take a long time to fully bite. And it was really not realistic to think that you could sanction a country like Russia, leave out energy exports, Gazprom Bank, for example, left out of the sanctions regime, and think that the economy wouldn't find ways to work around that. We've learned that lesson over and over in the history of sanctions. That doesn't mean they haven't had an effect. I look at Russia's GDP growth compared to where we thought they would be pre-invasion. Look at the long-term outruns from the IMF 10 years out. Look at some of the things that's happening in their markets, how they're having to have really stressed in terms of finding backfills for auto parts, for example. So it doesn't mean there's not an effect on the Russian economy. There's not strain on the Russian economy. And China has really stepped in to backfill the needs there. So Russia has to reorient a lot of how it does business. This introduces enormous long-term risk for them to be overly reliant on one country, China, as opposed to Europe. But it has not crippled the Russian economy. We should just be very upfront and straightforward about that. So has it hurt the Russian economy? Yes. But relative to expectations, it did less than what many thought at the beginning.
Well, it sounds like you were at least more sanguine about these effects early on than the rest of us. Is that right?
I mean, you know, I can go back to my statements in the first week, and I'm sure like many people, thought this is, wow, you know, the Russian economy is on the precipice here. And by the way, the central bank, Nabiullina, the central bank governor, took a series of steps in the early days, which stabilized the Russian economy, capital controls and other measures. So I think we all, you know, can do a lot of reflection of how we reacted in the first couple weeks and take a step back and take a deep breath and assess things as they are. One thing I would say is important is that macroeconomists, lawyers, and national security professors have to be in the room together when these sanctions packages are designed. I've written about this. A lot of times these packages are built, and then the macroeconomists come in later and say things like, what about substitution effects? And look at how they would work around these supply chains. I think one lesson the administration and the G7 more broadly has learned in this process is if you are going to try to sanction effectively, you got to put the economist in the room with those designing the packages in a way you haven't before. And you also have to think about this, not just in the Russia scenario, but if you ever got into a future conflict in the Taiwan Strait, if you were dealing with sanctions on China, we've done studies on this at the Atlantic Council. You really have to rethink the way you structure your sanctions and build the government apparatus to sanction another country. I think there's some lessons learned in this whole process for everyone.
Okay, let's talk now about the financing of the war, at least the external financing being sent to Ukraine. And in the U.S., we recently passed the Repo Act. But I think more importantly is this G7 agreement to provide $50 billion loan, and it would be financed, or at least the interest rate would be covered by interest earned on the blocked assets of Russia. Can you walk us through that, and what does it mean?
Well, it's incredibly innovative financial statecraft. And I think, you know, the administration deserves credit here. Dilip Singh, Deputy National Security Advisor, is the leader of this idea and has brought the G7 around on it. But let's just take a step back and think about what's happened to these assets over the past 2 years. So first, they were blocked. 2 years ago, it was a Saturday morning. Earlier that week, the G7 was saying they weren't going to block the assets. It was announced on a Saturday. And just to give you a sense of how quickly it came together, the Japanese didn't sign on to the G7 blocking of the assets only because it was overnight in Japan. And it was only the next morning when they signed on to the G7 statement. So I always just, you know, remind people of how quickly this idea came together. To sanction the foreign exchange reserves at this level of a country had never been done before. I don't think Putin expected it. I think this is why he diversified into euros between 2014 and 2022. It surprised him. And it changed the way a lot of countries think about the euro-dollar dynamic. So that was the blocking 2 years ago. Now, of course, immediately when they were blocked, the question started to be raised, well, what are you going to do with them? They're just sitting there. It's a huge chunk of money. Ukraine has growing and growing reconstruction and financing needs. Can you use this money? And for the first year, I think that conversation was on a low simmer. War was ongoing. There was funding going into Ukraine from the Americans, the Europeans, and it wasn't a top priority. Then we ran into dysfunction in Congress here in the U.S. and inability to pass new aid to Ukraine. And then the conversation really picked up speed in the U.S. Well, hold on. If we can't pass the supplemental aid package for Ukraine, why can't we tap these assets? Of course, as we talked about before, the assets are primarily in Europe, held in euros. It's not something the U.S. can just do unilaterally. And then when we ended up passing the aid in Congress, the conversation shifted a little. And it went from, what about instead of confiscating the assets, which the Europeans and others, in my opinion, rightly raise a lot of concerns about what that would mean for rule of law, what that would mean for the global role of the euro. What if we use the interest being earned on those assets, which didn't touch as many legal and geopolitical and financial red lines as confiscating the base assets would? So originally, about 7 months ago, the G7 agreed to use 1 year of interest on the assets. These assets are, by the way, parked in the ECB in overnight lending, and that's how they're earning interest. So they're doing okay, and they're getting, you know, a good amount of interest off the 220 base, $4 to $5 billion potentially annually. And that was the first agreement to get 1 year. But $4 to $5 billion was only meeting a small fraction of Ukraine's financing needs. Enter the new idea. Pull forward 20 years of future interest earnings. Now we're talking about close to $50 billion and give it to Ukraine. Now, there's all kinds of financial complexities around this. Who backstops it? Who's actually distributing the money? Who gets paid back if there's a negotiated peace settlement here and the assets are unblocked? So a lot of questions raised here, but this is the idea. I think it's incredibly creative, and it looks like it's going to bring Ukraine $50 billion by the end of this year, which is over half of their budget expenditure in 2023. So a significant amount of money.
So you bring up the issue of the legal precedents that one would create from just seizing, confiscating, and distributing the assets. So help me understand this. You're the lawyer here. I'm this American who says, go ahead, take it, seize
it. Yeah, which a lot
of Russians are the bad guys, right? They're the bad guys. They're at war. I mean, did we care about the Nazis?
Larry Summers, Bob Zelick, Phil Zelick, you know, they said the same.
So it's good to have thoughtful, careful, cautious people like you to kind of, you know, rein in the cowboys here on the policy frontier. So walk us through why it was important to be delicate with that issue.
Okay. Well, this is my perspective. First of all, we all want the same thing, those of us debating this. We want to give Ukraine the money it needs, one, to fight the war, and two, to rebuild its country. So I think it's just important to start from that framework.
Okay.
The question is how to do it. And so there are those who say, just take the assets and give them to Ukraine. There are others, and I count myself among them, who say, wait a second, we are not in direct military conflict with Russia. Under under international law and under our own law in the United States before the Repo Act was passed, we don't actually have legal authority to confiscate these assets. Now, the Repo Act did change that, or at least give the administration authority for the assets held in the United States. So that overcame the U.S. legal hurdle to it. But there's a broader geopolitical hurdle. And I was in India a few months ago. If you talk to countries and how they have reacted to the G7 sanctions, and think about the difference between blocking and confiscating, it is significant. I know that there are many people who say, what's the difference? You've already blocked them. Seizing them is no different. I think the rest of the world will take a much different signal if we were to seize those assets. And they would say, the dollar is no longer safe harbor. The euro is no longer safe harbor. And it would accelerate, and we can talk about this when we get into the alternative payment conversation, their research and their ability and their interest in working around the Western-based international financial system. So if there was a way to get Ukraine the money it needed without triggering all of those repercussions, that to me seemed like the right avenue to go down. And I think that's where we've gotten to here with the plan, the $50 billion plan, which, by the way, doesn't preclude seizing the assets down the road. You know, you're taking the future interest. The assets are still there.
Okay. So we want to preserve institutions. And also, I'm guessing the recovery after the war, once it's over, and given that we're not in direct conflict, it's just a quicker, smoother, you know, environment for international countries in order to keep the system intact as long as possible.
I do agree with that. I do think it's important to keep the assets as leverage in negotiation. This is something Russia wants back. So I think it's an important element to have out there when you negotiate. And I also think it's one thing to say, let's confiscate the assets and give it to Ukraine. I am the believer that, let's say the Europeans tomorrow agreed to that, it would be incredibly complicated to actually liquidate those from Euroclear, get them to Ukraine. So if the goal is to get Ukraine money fast, I think we needed to come up with alternatives. And that's what I believe we've actually done here.
Okay. Well, it's good to have people like you in D.C., you know, holding the reins, keeping us American cowboys in check.
There's a good debate. Everyone comes at it with good faith. We have debates at the Atlantic Council with colleagues here, you know, and I understand where the confiscation argument comes from. So I think we found a good solution for now, but this debate is not over, I think.
Sure. Okay, fair enough. Let's touch briefly on the Repo Act that we've mentioned already. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the Repo Act was basically, you know, it's been misinterpreted a little as now the U.S. will seize the assets that they have, which are not a huge amount, I think maybe 7% total of Russia's foreign exchange reserves that are in dollars held at the New York Fed. It just gives the administration the ability to do it. And I think that's what's important to say. And the purpose of the Repo Act, therefore, was to tell the Europeans, we could now do this if we want. But Treasury was very clear, even passage of the Repo Act, that they didn't want to do this unless it was coordinated across the G7. So I think the Repo Act served an important, you know, usefulness when it came to the U.S. going back to the G7 and saying, let's come up with a solution so we don't have to pull this lever Congress has now given us. And that's how I think about the Repo Act.
Okay. So that's Ukraine. And we want to move maybe on to a more general discussion of financial statecraft. But before we do, I'm just going to throw this out there. Something that, you know, I think about at least is, you know, the amount of money we have sent, the U.S. has sent, I should say, I think it totals $175 billion. And in my view, again, maybe I sound like a hawk here, but to me, that is money well spent. I had Brian Riddle on the podcast, and he's a big budget guy, typically works with Republicans. And he made the case, look, if that $175 billion, it was a little less when he came on the show, but that 100 plus billion is maybe the best spent part of the defense budget we have over the next 10 years if it really undermines Putin's ability to create havoc in the world. But I'll leave it at that. I do want to say, though, that there is a reasonable argument to be made for the money that was spent funding Ukraine. So let's move to financial statecraft. And, you know, my understanding is that what some call the weaponization of sanctions, which there's more to it than that, I understand, but that seems to be the kind of the hot topic that really took off after 9/11. Is that right?
You're right. And I think that one way to think about financial statecraft and economic statecraft is the evolution of these tools over the last 20 plus years. So you're right. Starting at 9/11 is a good point. Of course, sanctions pre-existed 9/11. We've
Sure.
been Cuba for, you know, 60 Yeah. years plus now. So it's not a new tool, but certainly accelerated post 9/11 with the creation of terrorism financial intelligence with inside Treasury right after September 11th. And the whole idea with sanctions after 9/11 was to complement what was going on in the military space. So we were going after Al-Qaeda, we were going after them militarily, and we wanted at the same time, understandably, to choke off the financial flows. And that's where a lot of the new sanctions tools and the financial sanctions we see got developed. Now, fast forward 10 years to the Iran negotiations. Sanctions are used in a different way there. Sanctions are used to put pressure on Iran to come to the negotiating table, but military force from the U.S. is not ruled out. That's in the background as a potential issue if we do not reach a resolution on the nuclear development. And that brought Iran to the negotiating table. We can have a separate debate whether it was a good agreement or not a good agreement, the JCPOA, but the sanctions played a role there. But military threat use of force was in the background. Now go to 2022, Russia-Ukraine. Direct military engagement from the U.S. is off the table explicitly. The administration's been clear about that. And financial sanctions and economic statecraft become the leading tool of the response. So just think about that evolution from 9/11, the complementary tool to military, Iran, the sort of side by side, you have the threat, but you're using sanctions. Now to Russia, we're going heavy on the financial statecraft, de-swifting, export controls, freezing, blocking the foreign exchange reserves, but we're not using direct military force. And I think that helps give you a sense of what's happened to these tools and how they've evolved over the last two decades.
Do you think that's a good development? I mean, on one hand, it seems great that we're not actually engaging in physical violent hacks. On the other hand, some say we're maybe using these tools too much. So where do you think the answer lies?
I do think it's fair to say that there's an over-reliance on the tools, because if you do not have to risk American blood directly, then you go to these tools and they seem very useful. But again, as I said at the beginning, they can't achieve everything they're sometimes asked to achieve, and they have to be used in complement with other tools of American foreign policy, American national security. And that's sometimes lost. We think the tools can do more than they can. And so they are useful. They are effective, but they cannot do it alone. And I think that's the lesson we're learning.
All right. Let's look forward to a possible conflict with China. What do you think would happen then with the use of financial statecraft?
Well, we've done a study on this. We'll share it with your listeners. We modeled out what would happen if we were in a crisis in the Taiwan Strait, and we're talking about short of direct full military engagement. So this is not the People's Liberation Army directly taking Taiwan, but some sort of gray zone activity, escalation, blockade, quarantine. And the G7 decides we don't want to respond militarily yet, but we want some financial sanctions, statecraft response. In that scenario, I think it's important for everyone to understand the immediate market reactions before the sanctions are even implemented could be extraordinarily dramatic. You could see 10-15% drawdown in global markets within a 48-hour period. Because remember, people don't know how bad this is going to get. They don't understand, are the Chinese taking Taiwan? Will the U.S. respond militarily? So in the uncertainty of that moment, just the strain on the global economy, liquidity, banks, you can imagine the ripple effects of the dominoes of what could happen in a short period. Then the question is, would the G7 respond in sanctions? And we estimated that they would, and I'll just put some numbers out there to think about. If we were to sanction the big four commercial banks in China, and I'm not talking the PBOC, I'm talking the big four, so not the central bank, it would put at risk in the global economy immediately about $3 trillion. That's the size of UK's entire economy. Okay, so just, you know, but just to put that in perspective, what we're talking about in terms of numbers. So then you say to yourself, well, if the markets are already reacting one way, are we really going to do that? Are we really going to basically send the global economy into a depression or worse? So you move on to individual sanctions. We're going to sanction party members. We're going to sanction military leaders. We're going to sanction their families. And I think we would do that. But that's not going to serve any deterrent effect. That would be priced in from the beginning as soon as they started escalating. The third dimension to consider, and I think the most likely to pursue, are export controls. Are there targeted sectors of the Chinese economy where there is asymmetric vulnerabilities, meaning they are overly reliant on the West for inputs, but we are not overly reliant on them? And there you can look at aerospace and civil aviation and engines and how Chinese aircraft work, where they really rely on Western imports, Boeing and Rolls-Royce, et cetera, where I think it's far more likely we pursue that kind of route. And let's all hope we never get to this situation. I think that's important to say, but it's far more likely we'd get there, which would have an impact on everyone economically, but far less than financial sanctions of the banks. So that's a little bit how I think and how our study broke down the potential sanctions impact in a Taiwan crisis.
Okay, we'll provide a link to that in our show notes for the listeners. But this challenge that you bring up in these various scenarios, that it would be difficult to apply these sanctions really in force like we did against Russia, just because the interconnectedness of the Chinese and U.S. economy, I guess China and the global economy, you know, it really speaks to the arguments that have been made in the past for globalization, for why is trade good? Well, one argument is that, well, the more interconnected you are, the harder it is to fight each other without harming oneself. And I think this really speaks to that. It's very costly to go to war with a country you're so closely integrated with. I mean, we run big current account deficits, they big run current account surpluses. Right. Just breaking that link would be so incredibly painful for both parties.
Agreed.
It's interesting to hear your analysis kind of underscore that point.
Yeah, and we did the analysis just to put numbers around a conversation we heard was happening in Washington. People said, oh, we'd sanction China, Taiwan crisis. So my mind immediately, David, went to, well, do we know what that means? Let's put some numbers around it to have a debate. Yeah. And you could all argue about our methodology, and there's a lot of gray area here. But one thing that I think was effective vis-a-vis Russia was the unity between the G7, specifically the U.S. and Europe. It's not clear to me that you would have that kind of unity if we came to a crisis in the Taiwan Strait. And that's a very different calculation for the Europeans than is Russia. So I think that's important to think about in this situation.
That's a great point. We may not have the unity, the multilateral effort that we now have against Russia. I wonder, on the other hand, though, did China look at the unified effort and say, oh my goodness, you know, we should think twice before trying to take Taiwan?
Well, I don't know. It's a good question. I think certainly Putin did not believe the U.S. and Europe would be as aligned as they've been on sanctions, which again, as I said, is why he diversified into euros, in my opinion, from 2014 to 2022. What Xi thinks watching it, I don't know. But my guess is that they do not think the Europeans and the Americans would be as aligned when it came to China as they are with Europe, because Europe is existential. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is existential to the Europeans, where Taiwan may not feel that way. But I think it may have given them pause, because if they didn't think it would happen with Russia, you can't know for sure what would happen in a crisis scenario.
Well, as you said, let's hope we don't come to this place where we have to actually consider these questions in reality. So let's hope this is just an exercise in speculation. So
I always say that it's important to say that about this study. You know, this is not a study about how to sanction China or a study that says you can't sanction China. It's just trying to understand, if we were to get to that place, we have to know what we're talking about, because you cannot do things ad hoc with the second largest economy in the world like we did with Russia.
Right. Well, maybe we can take some comfort from Xi Jinping's recent statement that the U.S. is forcing China into conflict. It almost kind of signaled that he doesn't want to, you know, get pushed into some kind of costly engagement with the U.S. All right, let's transition to cross-border payments. So we've talked about financial statecraft and the tools, and closely related to that is cross-border payments. In fact, we've been touching on this quite a bit. And you had a recent op-ed with, I believe, one of your colleagues, and the title of the op-ed is "The Geopolitical Imperative to Upgrade the Dollar." So we need to upgrade the dollar. And I want to read just a few parts from your intro, then let you run with this. But you say, "The ongoing debate about the health of the dollar is often framed in binary terms. Either its status as a global reserve currency is rapidly eroding, owing to geopolitics and the U.S. fiscal pressures, or it remains the unrivaled dominant currency with no competition in sight. The reality is much more complicated." Okay, so why is it much more complicated than those two binary outcomes?
Yes. Well, here we come back to where we started, David, the difference between how national security professionals and macroeconomists think about issues. So a macroeconomist will look at indicators of dollar strength. foreign exchange reserve holding, trade invoice, currency settlement. We look at this in our dollar dominance monitor, and they will say, you know what? The dollar is healthy. We don't see any significant changes over the past few years. We see it as the dominant currency. There's nothing that rivals it in terms of the currency that other countries want to hold. 80% of all cross-border payments touch dollars, so there's no issue here. Now, a national security professional will look at the dollar and say, hold on a second. Countries are building alternative financial plumbing around the dollar. And this is what we study at the Geoeconomics Center. And that might not erode your macroeconomist view of the dollar, but it erodes my ability as a national security professional to implement sanctions. And so here is really a distinction where we talk past each other in Washington. The dollar can be both healthy and weak at the same time. And what I think is happening is that we're looking at the wrong indicators. So we are looking at what I believe are lagging indicators. And that's what I just listed, the trade invoicing and the currency settlement, versus what I believe now are leading indicators. And that's the alternative financial plumbing, these pipes that are getting built between commercial banks around the world that don't need dollars to settle. And once the water turns on in those pipes, that's the money, then the lagging indicators might start to shift. So we try to pay a lot of attention to the leading indicators and say we in the U.S. need to pay attention to these upgrades that are happening in financial payments and settlement.
So you list as an example the Chinese cross-border interbank payment system. It's relatively new, right?
It's 9 years old. Yeah.
Okay. But it's being built up is what your point is, right? And I guess put some context. Yeah. How big is it? Where are we on its journey?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's about 8 or 9% of the banks that are in SWIFT, right? So if you have 11,000 banks in SWIFT, you're only a little over 1,000 here in SIPS. On the other hand, it's doubled in size in the past 2 years. So you can look at it in terms of its, you know, relative growth, or you can look at it macro compared to SWIFT. But the thing SIPS does, the Chinese Interbank Payment System, is that it's settlement and messaging combined. And that's different than SWIFT, which is only messaging. In our system, in the system most banks around the world use, you message in one platform, SWIFT, and you settle in another, usually CHIPS, US-based. SIPS combines the both. Now, does anyone believe that if we were building a system from scratch in the West, we wouldn't build a system that combined both, right? SWIFT is 50 years old. And at the time, that technology made sense to separate out the messaging and settlement. Doesn't make sense anymore. China's built a system that actually makes a lot more sense and provides some efficiencies. Now, the question is, if you're a bank that's on SIPS, say in Bangladesh or in Thailand, and you're doing business with China, you want to be on both. You want to be connected to SIPS and you want to be connected to SWIFT. And a lot of the SIPS transactions still need SWIFT because SIPS has such a limited banking network. When those banks want to reach other banks, they still have to connect through SWIFT. But the important thing about SIPS is that the Chinese are spending a lot of money. They're investing a lot of time. They're building out the network and countries want to be part of it. And none of it touches dollars in the Western financial system.
That's interesting. You talk about that having one system that both the communication and the actual transfer of the funds, where we have two, SWIFT and CHIPS. And it's kind of like the apps they have in China, right? I understand these apps are like one-stop shopping, everything on that. Now, of course, there's also concerns because the state can track you on those apps, but those apps are, you know, when they came out, they were light years ahead of what we had in the U.S. in terms of, you know, personal banking, payment, connection, social media, all in one. So we have a show, a previous guest on that topic, but it's interesting that the Chinese are doing this in this other area too, this international payment system.
Yeah. I mean, one way to think about this, David, is that de-dollarization or wanting to work around the dollar is nothing new. It's existed for as long as the dollar's been the world's reserve currency. But I think financial technology is finally catching up with the demand. And that's what's different, say, 5 years ago, if we were having this conversation. There are new tools, fintech tools, that allow countries to work around the dollar cheaper than it would have been for them in the past. Doesn't mean there's not huge hurdles to overcome. Liquidity is one of them, right? Renminbi is not going to provide what you need in a cross-border commercial banking environment. So I don't mean to say any of this is happening overnight, but the interest is there and the technology is developing rapidly.
Okay, so the absolute level of SIPS is low, but its growth rate is just really rapid. And that's the concern.
That's right. And SIPS is not the only program. We can talk about the others, but it's one of the most significant.
So you also talk about other projects being developed beyond SIPS. You've talked about Project Enbridge, China, Hong Kong, Thailand, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and work that goes along with the BIS. Maybe talk about those developments too.
Yeah, Enbridge is a very significant project, and it's worth spending a minute on it. So what is Enbridge? First of all, the Bank for International Settlements runs a series of central bank digital currency projects, both retail, how you and I would buy a cup of coffee with a central bank digital currency, and wholesale, which is what Enbridge is, which is how commercial banks transfer money to each other. When we say wholesale central bank digital currency, all we're really saying is using distributed ledger, using advanced technology to settle cross-border compared to the way we do it, which can rapidly speed up settlement times. They can settle cross-border between these banks within a matter of minutes as opposed to days. You know, a lot of cross-border bank settlements can take T plus one, as we say in, you know, in this industry, so a day or 2 days. So it can rapidly reduce settlement times. And it can make these transactions across border. And importantly, they don't need the dollar. Because if you don't have this settlement lag time and you're not worried about the stability of the transaction and the transaction settling, suddenly maybe your need for dollars is lessened. There's still liquidity issues, which we can talk about. Enbridge is the most significant and advanced of these wholesale central bank digital currency projects. Its founding members, the People's Bank of China, Hong Kong Monetary Authority, Thailand, UAE, and just 2 weeks ago, as you said, Saudi Arabia joined. And that got some attention back in the US, because here you have the world's largest commodity exporter, oil exporter, now joining a cross-border payment platform with China. And you can easily see how this could help fulfill some rhetoric that's been in the past few years about invoicing oil exports, for example, in renminbi instead of dollars. And so this is why Enbridge has gotten attention. Could it be a platform to accelerate ambitions to do cross-border settlement outside the dollar?
So would Enbridge compete with SIPs? I mean, it seems like they're doing similar things. I mean, I know they're different, but would they be different markets or the same market?
You know, Enbridge is just in the pilot phase and SIPs is 9 years on. Okay. And so you can certainly see a world where what Enbridge is doing is not dissimilar from what SIPs is doing. But I think the Chinese are far from having to confront that challenge because they're just starting to onboard other countries and other commercial banks. But I do think because of the reach of Enbridge and the technology behind Enbridge, it's one of these advances that could become the platform that everyone gravitates to. And maybe a SIPS network gets transferred into it. There's all kinds of challenges that would be thought about, but I don't think they're immediate concerns. But just to put the scale of interest on this for your listeners, in the People's Bank of China, 300 people are dedicated to work on digital currency issues. So this is larger than the staff of most central banks. So I think it just gives you a sense of where they think the future is, where they're investing resources. You know, we do not put any of that kind of interest and money and resources into these issues in the US. We have a perception in the US that things are basically fine. The dollar's fine. The cross-border payment mechanisms are fine. Everyone uses them. We don't have to worry about, you know, these potential rivals coming. I personally think that's not the right posture, but we think about it a little differently right now.
So going back to Enbridge, what technology is it using? Some kind of distributed ledger, tokenization?
Yep, it's tokenization. It's distributed ledger. Okay. It's settled on this platform where basically all the parties can see the transactions at the same time. Okay. So that's why it's called a central bank digital currency. It's important to understand, you know, commercial banks have master accounts just like we do here in the US. Yeah. With their central bank. They send the money cross-border. All we're really talking about in CBDC is a faster way to do it because of the use of distributed ledger technology. That's very different than a retail CBDC conversation, which is a direct liability of the central bank, like paper cash. So I think wholesale and CBDC deserve kind of separate channels of debate and conversation.
Yeah, so you bring up a good topic that's been brought up on the show many times before. And I think there's fears and concerns, probably more about retail CBDCs, privacy issues. Yep. Can we really trust Uncle Sam, even though they have good intentions at some point? There's Operation Choke Point. You look at those Canadian truckers whose bank accounts were frozen. There is this concern if we go down that path. But what you're suggesting, if I understand you correctly, is this wholesale angle, merely a cross-border payment advantage or innovation to further enhance dollar dominance.
Yeah, put aside the retail debate and the privacy debate, which is a legitimate one to have. There's no privacy concerns in wholesale CBDC. The commercial banks are already working with the Fed through master accounts, as are commercial banks and their central banks. in every country. All we're talking about is a faster way to settle that transaction. But the word CBDC has got so tied up in the privacy debate that sometimes people say wholesale CBDC. So I just think it's from a dollar dominance, from an international payments, we need to think a lot about wholesale and cross-border settlement. It's incredibly important. And to the Fed's credit, you know, they are now engaged in their own project called Project Agora with the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and a few others. And I think this is the right way to go, because if the dollar, the euro, the pound, and the yen coordinate, I don't think there's any country in the world that can afford to be outside that system. But we can't just sit back on our current technology. We have to be willing to innovate.
So help me understand how wholesale CBDC for the Fed would be different than from what it has with reserves. Reserves are already digital, right? People have FedMaster accounts. Even other central banks have FedMaster accounts, right? So I guess help me understand, how would this be a step forward or any different than what we already have?
It's the tokenization of the reserves. And so therefore, it potentially allows for faster settlement cross-border and some efficiencies and different ways that other banks could participate. But it doesn't change the relationship between commercial banks and their master accounts with the Fed. I just think of it as a technological upgrade to the existing relationship, which is why it's different than a retail CBDC.
So since you are a national security guy as well as a finance expert, are there any concerns that if the U.S. did go to this wholesale CBDC approach that's on the distributed ledger, that's tokenized, that it would make it harder to implement its financial sanctions?
I think that the risk is inaction, meaning there's more risk if we don't do anything. These alternative systems where the Fed is not involved get built up. They become pretty efficient. More countries use them. And even if they don't displace the dollar as the world's reserve currency, which I don't think is happening anytime soon, those systems could still be used to do illicit finance, to do activities that those countries don't want OFAC and Treasury to know about. So from my perception, I don't see a risk of sanctions if the Fed gets involved. I think that would help, because if the Fed's involved, then the U.S. and the U.S. banking system is involved, and that helps make sure sanctions can continue to be effective. If we aren't involved, I do worry about what grows up in the absence of U.S. leadership.
So you think that to maintain our current ability to impose these primary and secondary sanctions on banks and actors around the world, we need to proceed with wholesale CBDC and other distributed ledger tokenized approaches to cross-border payments?
The way I would say it is that to maintain U.S. leadership in the international financial system, to maintain the way we use the dollar to advance national security goals, the Fed has to work with other G7 central banks, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, et cetera, to ensure that all of our cross-border payments mechanisms use the most advanced technology available and bring other countries into that network.
Okay, so when the BIS talks about CBDC, it's also thinking primarily in terms of wholesale CBDC, not retail.
It does both. The BIS does both. They do a lot of retail projects. One way to think about the BIS is they're responsive to the demands of their members, which are about 50 central banks around the world.
Okay.
There are some central banks who want to work with the BIS on retail, some that want to work on wholesale, some that want to work on both. You can see all of it. We have a CBDC tracker, so you can track all the different projects there. But the BIS does both.
Yeah, I guess the issue I see with this approach is that CBDC, the term, has been so tainted politically, at least in the U.S., that maybe having a different word for wholesale CBDC might be useful.
Yeah, I'm all for that, by the way. I know the terminology doesn't matter. I just want to get to the right end goal here. And
yeah,
if that's what helps everyone. I do think it was probably a mistake years ago to lump these two together, because they are very different, as we talked about.
Right. And I understand people who call for retail CBDC, Fed accounts. Morgan Ricks is a friend of the show. He's big advocate of Fed accounts. But I also understand the concerns of privacy and all those issues as well. And I just think the reality on the ground is, with Republicans in Congress, after our most recent presidential debate, a Republican in the White House, it seems like CBDC might be dead on arrival, if that's how you frame it. But maybe if there's another way to package this. But in any event, let's move from wholesale CBDCs to private sector attempts. I mean, are there crossovers, or are they distinct efforts when you think of things like, Bitcoin or other private attempts to create distributed ledger efforts?
Well, I think the most relevant one to talk about is probably dollar-backed stable coins, right? Because if you're thinking of CBDC, a digital version of a dollar, a lot of companies and, you know, would say, well, we already have one. It's a dollar-backed stablecoin. And I think 98 or 99% of pegged stablecoins, those that are anchored to fiat, are pegged to the dollar. And so the question is that a digital dollar? And we could debate that, you know, if it is or isn't. If you can redeem it at one-to-one, it has a certain attractiveness around the world. And Tim Massett, who was former chair of the CFTC, wrote a great paper on this, basically comparing dollar-backed stablecoins to the rise of euro dollars post-World War II in the 50s and 60s, meaning basically a creation of dollars outside the Fed's purview, which is one way to think about the rise of dollar-backed stablecoins all over the world. Now, I think what we have to be wary of and what a lot of countries are concerned about is what they were called digital dollarization of their economies. So dollarization is nothing new in emerging markets, the long-term phenomenon, but this digital dollarization, the access to dollar-backed stablecoins, potentially accelerate because you can imagine in a range of countries how citizens would flock to that kind of asset, even outside a financial crisis in that country, let alone during a financial crisis. So I think dollar-backed stablecoins are probably the best asset to think about in the private sector space competing with CBDCs.
Okay. So where do you see this conversation going? I mean, we get past the election. I mean, do you see the U.S. moving forward, whether, you know, being pushed or pulled or just is there interest, momentum to move forward on this topic?
So here's where I think we're going after the election. One way or the other, the dollar and the dollar-based infrastructure has to be upgraded. It should start with SWIFT, in my opinion. You know, SWIFT has already put forward plans internally to upgrade their systems. The G10 central banks, so the G7 plus Switzerland and a few others oversee SWIFT, they should support those plans. And I do think you're going to see a lot of energy behind that after the election. Let's upgrade this infrastructure that exists and use the best technology available so we make sure the Western based payment systems are fit for purpose in the future. Then I think you're going to see more effort on the U.S. side on wholesale CBDC. I think most folks at the Fed understand that this cross-border payment issue is important. We're not going to probably do as much, no matter what, on the retail side. I think that's pretty clear. But we should recognize the Europeans are about to roll out a digital euro. That's a retail CBDC in the eurozone. The Bank of England has said they're going to have one by the end of the decade, as has the Bank of Japan. So we could easily live in a world in 2030 where there's a digital euro, a digital yen, a digital pound, and not a Fed digital dollar. Now, we may be fine with that, but I think that's kind of where we're headed, at least in the near term.
You also mentioned FedNow, which is a real-time payment system that the Fed established recently. And of course, the banks have their own version of the real-time payment system they set up as well. Interesting history there, how those two things emerged together. And I've had some guests on who say because there's two of them and because you need economies of scale to make these things cost efficient, they may end up both being not as good as they otherwise would be if they're just one real-time payment system in the U.S. But do you see a role for one of these systems, or maybe both of these systems, to play in this future world?
Yeah, I mean, FedNow will play a role going forward. The Fed's invested in it. I think both of the systems are going to run in parallel, at least in the near term. And anything that happens with wholesale CBDC is really primarily conceived of now in the international space, where FedNow is in the domestic space. So it's important to say that both can exist together. I do think, though, technology moves very quickly in payments. The Fed has been involved in payments technology working with the private sector since its founding. I mean, you can go back to, you know, 1920s and 1930s and check settlement and all the history of the Fed and their involvement with that. But there's a risk of us being overly invested in what I call Blu-ray technology, while DVD is being developed, meaning that it moves so fast. If you spend 5 years building the FedNow system, but the rest of the world is building distributed ledger payment systems, you got to make sure you're putting your money in the best technology. And I think that's a risk because we move slowly in the U.S. Obviously, we need appropriation from Congress, but we can't be behind the curve on these financial innovations. I think that's the main thing I'm trying to convey. And the rest of the world's moving very quickly, and I'm not sure we always appreciate that back here in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, this again takes me back to the role the private sector may play. Maybe if the government has a hard time staying, you know, up to the edge of the frontier of cutting technology, maybe stable coins lead the way, incentivize the Fed to follow. I don't know. I mean, think of like Custodia's case right now against the Fed and obtaining a master account. Let's say they do get one and they do innovate and they maybe some stable coin. I don't know where the story goes, but you can see some path forward where the Fed works hand in hand with some of these private firms.
You can. And I think what's really important here is just that the Fed sends a signal that this is a priority. Doesn't mean they have to do it all, but I think the private sector would key off that. You know, if Chair Powell or other senior leaders at the Fed said, we think cross-border payments are critical, we think improving domestic payments infrastructure are critical, there's a range of technologies and options to do it, but this will help maintain the dollar as the world's reserve currency, I think you'd see a kind of galvanizing effect across commercial banks to say, we need to invest in this. Many are, but many more would. And you also need regulatory clarity, right? Stablecoins is a great example of that. We have no legislation passed on stablecoins, not likely to get any in this Congress, maybe in the next one. And that is not just for our benefit domestically, but to the rest of the world that, as we talked about, is asking questions about our dollar-backed stablecoins and what it means for their economy.
So, Josh, we are actually getting near the, I believe, 80th anniversary of Bretton Woods. And I understand that your team is working on some projects surrounding that development.
Yeah, we are. I mean, this is an important anniversary, I think. And as I talked about in the beginning, we've been reminded in the U.S. of what geoeconomics means and the intersection of financial and national security and foreign policy. And that's what the creation of the IMF and the World Bank were really about at their founding. And so for July 1st, which is, you know, the marking of the opening of the Bretton Woods Conference, we'll bring together senior IMF, World Bank, U.S. and U.K. officials to talk about the history of the founding of the institutions. And then later in the month in Rio, on the sidelines of the G20 finance ministers meeting down there, we're going to do events marking the conclusion of the Bretton Woods Conference. And there we're going to bring in a range of emerging market voices. I think it's really interesting that in the last 4 years, Indonesia hosted the G20, then India hosted the G20, now Brazil, next year South Africa. And many people haven't focused on this yet, but guess who hosts after South Africa? 2026, the United States. And so the G20 is coming back to the US after four major emerging markets have hosted it. And I think we have to think in the United States, what does multilateral international economic coordination mean in this new era? And that's the work we're doing at the Atlantic Council to help re-envision, reimagine, rejuvenate international economic coordination for the next 20 years of the Bretton Woods institution. So if we get to the 100th anniversary, I think they're going to look a lot different than they do today.
Yeah, sounds like you have a very fun and fascinating job there, working on these issues, hosting these events. I will mention I recently visited the Bretton Woods Hotel in New Hampshire and was able to see some of the rooms. They have them marked off. And they used to have, actually, I was told, on the doors of each of the hotel rooms who stayed in each room.
That's great.
But those name tags got ripped off and they were stolen. So they don't have them anymore. But very interesting hotel. It's huge, filled with history. I really enjoyed my time there. I was at a conference. Let's close, Josh, by just circling back to the issues we've been on, and that is the issue of, you know, dollar dominance going forward. Will we be able to maintain it? And of course, your argument, your concern is we need to innovate, maintain a very cutting edge, technology driven frontier of dollar financial assets. So you've brought up a number of issues that we need to be mindful of. What's happening with SIPs and some of these other competing systems? What metrics should we be following to kind of be aware of what's happening in this debate?
Yeah, the real way to think about this is less about how countries hold foreign exchange reserves and how much are in dollars, which is how we're traditionally measuring this, versus how money is being settled. I think this is really where the future is. And do we see any decrease in the dollar being used as a form of cross-border settlement? We don't yet, but if that starts to change, to me, this will raise some more alarm bells that the alternative financial plumbing is starting to have some effect. And I think even if it doesn't change the big numbers, you know, if it doesn't decrease by 5%, we need to understand not just the macro level, but if it's changing marginally, is it being changed because we think illicit finance and sanctions evasion is happening through that? That's harder to track, but I think it's important we look at both.
Okay, with that, our time is up. Our guest today has been Josh Lipsky. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dive deeper into our research at mercatus.org/monetary policy. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. If you like this podcast, please consider giving us a rating and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the show. Find me on Twitter at David Beckworth and follow the show at macro_musings.